Empire itself is not a liberator. It creates means, not goals.
The tools for solving the problems are knowledge and understanding. Know the facts, but see how they fit in the big picture.
Hello and welcome everyone to another exciting episode of Labor ins Ohr. In our podcast, we are looking over the shoulders of the giants in science and trying to understand how the scientific machinery operates. My name is Christoph.
And my name is Marta.
And I'm Bernd. And I'm absolutely thrilled about the upcoming conversation with our remarkable guest, Dame Anne Glover. An outstanding figure in biology, academia, and science policy. Her journey began in Edinburgh and Cambridge, where her passion for biochemistry ignited a career marked by groundbreaking research on various topics like environmental microbiology or how cells respond to stress on a molecular level. Apart from her career in research, she is most famously known for her roles as Scotland's first ever chief scientific advisor, and later as the first and only singular chief scientific advisor to the president of the European Commission from 2012 to 2014. Currently, she presides as chair of the governing board at the Scottish Industrial Biotechnology Innovation Centre and as scientific advisor at the University of Strathclyde. It's a great honor to have you on the show, Anne.
For me too. Thank you.
Bernd already mentioned some of your contributions and we did a little background check. And while we were doing that, I came across a podcast and in which you told the story of how a midnight swim in the Algarve actually inspired you to use a protein called luciferase to make soil bacteria shine in the dark, right? And actually, I remember this episode yesterday, not only because we were preparing this interview, but me too. I used luciferase in my parasites. So I thought, okay, what a funny correlation. But I think our listeners are more interested in hearing about your research than in mine. So Anne, maybe could you tell us a little bit what your research was about?
Okay, so I've always been a very curious person, so I think it was obvious to me and all my family and those who knew me that I would go into a career in science, because a career in science is fantastic. It's all about discovery and adventure and lots of uncertainty, which can be a very good thing. So when I studied for my undergraduate degree, which was in biochemistry, I was just very interested in how cells worked and the fact that you can't see them and that you have to design experiments to almost at one step remove figure out what's happening inside cells and how cells respond to their environment. Maybe a little simpler for microbes because we're looking at single cells, but then in human cells, they have to interact with each other as well as the environment. So amazing. Anyway, when I, this is a very personal story. So I did my PhD on a bacterium called Halobacterium halobium. And it was originally isolated from the Dead Sea because it can tolerate very high salt concentrations. And I suppose what I was interested in is looking at how it does this and how that whole system is controlled, how you can, so it essentially gathers energy by a protein which captures light energy like chlorophyll in plants and then transmits that to through an ATPase to generate intracellular energy. So very biochemical. And then I was thinking about a postdoc. But on a personal note, by that time, I'd met my to-be husband. And so that was right at the end of my career, I guess, in Edinburgh. And so he came with me to Cambridge, where I did my PhD. He's not a scientist, but he made a location change so he could be with me. And we were very equitable. So I said, if you do that for me, then next time you can choose where we go. And well, a bit disappointingly for me, he chose Aberdeen, which is in the north of Scotland, and it's very cold and always, even in the summer. And it was not my idea of a fun place to go. However, I went there and learned lots of different sorts of technologies. I was looking at a slime mold and the role of repetitive DNA in the genome of that slime mold. But within about 6 months, there were adverts for lectureships. And I thought I wasn't totally wedded to the research I was doing, but I was obviously going to stay in Aberdeen. And so then I had to set up, I got one of those lectureships and set up a research program and just wanted to look at lots of different things. But one of the main things is I, through other people, other scientists, I got very interested in the diversity of microbes in the environment and the fact that often you can't study them very well in the environment. You have to try and extract them and culture them in the lab, but we can only culture such a small percentage, less than 5% or so of microbes in the lab. So the vast majority are the ones that are still out there. So I had to think of a way of how could I track them in the environment? How could I look at their activity in the environment and see how that was affected? And that's where the Portuguese midnight swimming came in, because I mean, it was mainly my PhD student at the time when we were swimming. She stood up and she just looked, well, I can still see it now. She looked incredible. She just was sparkling and luminescing all over. And then I stood up and she said, well, look at you. So I thought, well, I didn't know anything about bioluminescence. And I thought, I need to find out. And the genes were available, and I could express them in bacteria. So that was the start of really the bulk of my research career, was using luciferase as a means of tracking organisms. And as you will know, Christoph, if you use luciferase as well, but you can also use luciferase as a means of identifying how active organisms are as well, if the luciferase is expressed inside the cell, because it can measure energy metabolism in the cell. And that became incredibly helpful for things such as cleaning up environmental waste, because you don't want to, historically, we've mostly dug the waste up and dumped it somewhere else. But much better if you can use the microbial populations in the soil to actually digest the waste and get rid of the problem. It's sustainable to do that. And so that was one big application, is looking to see how we could clean up both detect environmental waste and then identify the conditions for cleaning it up. I've said enough, but that's a bit of history.
Seems like, Christoph, I have to go to visit you in the Algarve to get some inspiration too.
Yeah, I could talk with you, I think, for hours. But I also found it really inspiring that your career path doesn't sound like a real straightforward path, that you always had in mind, okay, I want to study this soil bacteria, but no, you rather follow different direction. And this sounds really inspiring to me, because not only that I have more or less the same strategy, but it's also cool that in science we have this kind of opportunities. And this actually brings me to my next question, because then after being a professor in Aberdeen, you became scientific advisor to the Scottish Parliament. I don't know if the job description is correct. Now, my question is, how did that happen? What brought you into public service?
Okay, so first of all, let me say that your analysis is completely right. So I didn't plan a career. And I know a lot of people who do, and actually I find it almost a bit intimidating, but I think that's just we're all very different. So I know that I would have always done science, but and very interested in research. But how did I get into that kind of chief scientific advisor role? Well, I had no experience of that, although like most of us, most scientists, you might sit on the editorial board of a journal, or in my case, I'd also had some experience of sitting on the governing board of one of our big environmental research agencies, the government agency that distributes research funding for the environment. I had some idea of governance, you know, how decisions were made and what the pressures were. So having that in my background, it was actually one of my colleagues at Aberdeen, a very good friend and colleague. And he'd got me interested in microbes because until I met him, I wasn't much interested. But he said to me, did you see that Scotland is advertising for a chief scientific advisor? They've never had one. And he said, you'd be good at that. And well, the first question I said was, why do you think I would be good at that? Because I'd never done anything like that. And he said, well, you know, you're always prepared to talk to people. You've got interests in a very broad area of science. I mean, it's true that I'm a biologist, but I'm very interested in cosmology. I'm interested in engineering. I'm just curious. And I am interested in how you take the knowledge from the research that we all do, which mostly is paid for by the public, and how do you get that knowledge to be helpful for the public? You know, what routes can you use? And one of them is to influence the making of policies which affect us all by governments. And I am very keen on the idea of evidence-based policy. So instead of having policies based on just political philosophy, have them on more solid ground. And if they are based on evidence, then my argument would be that they will be effective policies and that they are much more likely to be long-lived and provide some stability rather than the philosophical ones, which can change effectively overnight with a government. So he encouraged me to apply. I had no real I just thought, well, why not? And one of my mottos in life is, what have you got to lose? And if the answer is, well, if the answer was everything, I probably wouldn't do it. But if the answer is, well, not much really, because if you apply and you don't get the job, you've lost nothing, but you've gained the experience, which is very useful. Every experience is useful, even the bad ones. And I just thought, well, I'll go for it. And I was lucky enough to be appointed, and particularly lucky because they had not had a chief scientific advisor before. I'd never been one before. So in fact, when I took the job, neither of us knew what we were supposed to be doing. So I could actually shape the role in a way that I thought would be most effective. And that did change over, I was there for almost 6 years, and it did change a lot over that period of time, understanding what worked and what didn't work. And of course, there are other chief scientific advisors around the world, although it's mainly a kind of Anglo-Saxon type concept. I don't know why that is, but I could learn from them. And mostly they were very generous with their time and advice. So I didn't have to do it completely alone, but it is incredibly rewarding.
Okay, thanks. Before we dive deeper into the actual work of scientific advisor, could you just very briefly answer me, what did you get more than the experience, and was it a good or a bad experience?
It was fantastically good. It's very hard to compare your research career with a career in advice with governments and so on, because they're so different. And I love them both. But I've thought about this a lot. I loved my scientific research career, But by the time I was becoming to be about 50, I thought, well, you know, I've got a very successful lab, very proud of my students and the people who'd worked in my lab, and very much enjoyed collaborating with people, particularly through European projects where you got to know people right across the European Union or in the European research area. And we became friends. And in fact, earlier on this week, we had a wonderful Zoom conference of people on a particular project, but that was 25 years ago, that project was. And we all came back to celebrate the man in the European Commission. His name was Yanis Economidis, and he was the kind of stimulator of the program within the European Commission. He worked for the Commission. So, you know, so those friendships are terrific. But I loved working as an advisor to government, both in Scotland and at the European Commission, because you see how science systems work in lots of different countries. They're all different. You meet scientists from lots of different countries, and they all have different issues that they want addressed. And I felt that I had some possibility of making things better when it came to two main things: how policy was made at the European Commission, and secondarily, how we prepared for future uncertainties that were bound to come along, like the COVID epidemic that we've all been subject to, or pandemic rather. So that kind of foresighting piece, imagining, knowing what was happening in science and engineering, and somehow trying to prepare something like the Commission to be able to react very quickly to opportunities and threats that might face the European Union, and what could we do to prepare ourselves. So it was the actual work was wonderful, and the people I worked with, particularly at the European Union, when you had at that time 28 member states, and also the rest of the world comes to Europe because it's such a huge block of, you know, half a billion people. I mean, of course people are going to come to Brussels and talk about their programs, whether they come from South America, North America, Australasia, Africa. So I met all of those people as well. It was wonderful.
Yeah. You're advertising the position really well. Maybe I think about a career change.
But so I'm just curious, because like you said, they were both in Scotland and in Europe, they were newly created positions. So you were the first one, the first of a kind. So how was it? How was your daily job? Did you have any routine, or it was impossible to set one? Because I guess you had many different roles, many different areas to cover.
So one of the pleasures was that there wasn't ever really a routine. And if you think about a life in research or a life in science, that's probably a definition of that. You don't really have routines. Every day is different. And I really like that. I like not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, we've all got a rough idea of what will happen tomorrow, but we don't know. So as a chief scientific advisor, both in Scotland and at the European Commission, I had to get to know people. I had to get to know how the system worked, because it was totally foreign to me. I had no idea how governments worked. Politicians are very unusual people. and I still don't at all understand them. I'm speaking very personally from the UK, but our politics is getting worse and worse, because people of different parties don't behave decently towards each other. And I think that lets us as citizens down. I don't want to see a politician of one party, even although it's one I might sympathize with, I don't want to see them personally insulting other politicians. And I find it desperately depressing. So I had to get to understand what, you know, what press the button, we would say. How can I activate the interest of a politician? And so I'll tell you a story without naming names, but in Scotland, a particular politician who was potentially very useful for me in getting the evidence-based policymaking agenda. So the politician was in government, and I was trying to persuade them of both why research should be supported in Scotland, and also why the knowledge coming from research was so key to government. And the politician always promised to have a meeting with me, and without fail, every time when I made the short, it's a 10-minute walk from my office to the Parliament building, I would get a phone call from my office to say the politician's just cancelled again, so doesn't want to meet you. So we ended up being, by coincidence, at an evening event, and I walked up to the politician and said, it's me. We've never met because you keep cancelling the meetings, but I'd love to come and talk to you about the research that happens in Scotland and so on. And they sort of, weren't very interested. And without saying the words, he said almost, "What's in it for me? Why would that be interesting to me?" And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I thought, as all scientists do, I thought on my feet and I said, "Science will make you look good." And from that time on, that particular politician always wanted to have meetings with me. But from my point of view, the politician also talked about what I spoke to them about. So at if I was very interested in, for example, in Scotland, we had an astronomy technology centre where we manufactured equipment which is used globally to, either to be launched into space to examine, do astronomical measurements or whatever. So the equipment is all over the place, and they designed this equipment. And if I spoke to the politician about how interesting that was and how the approach was useful for business, that it was helpful to us, because he was saying, why would you be interested in space and things? And I was saying, well, have you heard of space weather? If you get a really big burst of electromagnetic radiation, from the sun, it can knock out power systems. So, to be resilient, we should know about that and so on. And so it's just the biggest lesson that I learned. So no routine, but everyday learning. And it was to understand, I knew what was important to me, but was to understand what was important to the people I was trying to influence, and then modify the message so that they would not just listen to me, but they would want to seek me out to ask things and listen to me. So that's the trick, is knowing your audience, I guess.
Yeah, but so like you said, I guess politicians are very interesting organism, let's say, and they also reason in a completely different way than we scientists do. Well, we are very set on data and evidence. They are more focused on opinions, the emotions of the public, the emotions of also the party they represent. So did you have any, did you clash often with them, and did you have many difficulties in making yourself understood?
Yeah, I did, because there are very, very few politicians, whether I think about the United Kingdom or if I think about the European Union and the different member states, there are remarkably few politicians with a background in science. So most of them, and actually that's also true, there are some countries that are a little different. So I was saying it was also true for policymakers. And in some countries, policymakers have got a much more technical background. I'm thinking of France, for example. That's quite an interesting example. I'm not sure it means that there are better policies, but anyway, they at least know what scientists are talking about. Whereas both with policymakers and politicians, they are rather, if I'm honest, and I don't intend to be rude to them, but I think they're generally frightened of science. And I can remember a politician saying to me once, you know, because I'd queried why, you know, why don't you celebrate our scientists, you know, because, you know, everything in our world is based on our knowledge generated through research and science. So why would they not be more mainstream? And at that time, he said to me, well, let me tell you this, I can bluff in almost any area. So if a journalist asks me about, you know, A, B or C, I can bluff the answer. But if they ask me about science, I can't bluff, because somebody will know if I'm saying the right thing or not. And so it's easier for me just not to talk about it. And so that's I find that quite difficult, to try and empower politicians to talk more about science and to feel comfortable both in talking about it, but also if a journalist did ask them, but, you know, are you sure about the longevity of that drug under these conditions or something? They would say, well, that's a technical question. I can't answer that. But, you know, we do have, you know, an excellent scientific advisory group who's giving us the information on this based on evidence. That's the answer they need to give. But I think if it's an area you're not familiar with, you do feel very uncertain. I would be the same. So that's a human aspect of politicians. One of the few human aspects.
It should really be more normalized to have to not know everything and to check something up when someone asks you.
Yeah. And also to say you don't know.
Yeah.
Because I've had to say that a lot of times, because sometimes, you know, if I'm giving a general talk on science, and I like to communicate science a lot, particularly to the public, because I'm acutely aware that they pay for me to do my research. So I should make as much effort as I can that they then can get the same enjoyment out of the knowledge that I can, you know, by communicating what I do and why it's important and why it might make a difference to them and their lives or the planet they live on or whatever. So I think that, the communication piece is vitally important, and we don't all start off being good communicators. I mean, we kind of practice things that work and things that don't work. But to do any job, particularly one as a chief scientific advisor, you need to enjoy people's trust. And I think that people will trust you if you try to be as transparent as possible. And you're also honest about what you don't know. You know, so I think you should try as much as possible to do that. Although in some positions, like the chief scientific advisor position, there are often journalists with agendas or politicians with agendas who are trying to trap you into saying something, and you're busy being honest. And sometimes you can get caught out because, you know, there are lots of tricks when you're being interviewed, not an interview like this, but, you know, where people are deliberately trying to entrap you to say something. Even like one of the best pieces of advice I got was never repeat the question. You know, so.
Really?
How so?
Yeah, well, I'll give you an example. If you know, somebody asked me, could ask me, do you think eating saturated fats can give you heart attacks? And if I said, eating saturated fats can give you heart attacks, well, I don't think so. And then I could go on. But if it's not a live interview, and this has happened to me, then they just cut out the piece of information that will make a more, in their view, a more interesting or controversial story.
Yeah,
and then it's very hard to deny because they say, but you said it, we heard you say that. So yeah, that was one of the many tips I got.
Oh, that is very impolite as well to do that. But coming to a more a positive part as science communicator, do you remember any particular situation where you thought, okay, I've made a significant impact, or where you could convince the president of the European Commission?
Actually, the president of the European Commission, whilst I was in position, because my position was a personal appointment by him, because there wasn't an established role at the European Commission. So I reported directly to him. So that was José Manuel Barroso. And I have to say, he was quite an amazing person. He was ferociously hardworking. But the thing that surprised me, because he had a legal background, that was his specialism, but he used to read New Scientist for fun, you know, so when he was relaxing, he didn't relax with a, you know, an interesting novel or a round of golf or going out for a, well, he may have done those things as well, I don't know, but he would read New Scientist, and then when we would meet up, he'd say, tell me about this. You know, why do I need to know about this? And there were a number of occasions which were very directed because of perhaps outbreaks of disease across the European Union, where he wanted to know more about it and, you know, what should he do? And I was also able to make him familiar with just the outstanding powerhouse that European research is. And I think, you know, he saw things in small bits or pieces that he would, you know, that would come across his desk, but he didn't have that overall view of, you know, European nations. And I know that I can't describe them all by one phrase, but one thing that I find fairly common across like all member states of the EU is a general modesty when it comes to talking about the quality of the research that's done. You know, people don't say we're the best, we're the greatest, and so on. And okay, and I'm just making the comparison. In North America, whether you're the best or the greatest, you'll probably say so. Because here's an interesting thing. People more or less believe what you tell them. So, you know, if I tell you often enough that I'm the greatest at something, you probably will have this thing in the back of your mind with thinking, well, she's probably quite good at that. You know, why would she be saying that? Whereas I could just be saying it to convince you, but with no evidence. So I think the fact that President Barroso was willing to meet with me fairly regularly, given how busy he was, the fact that he was open-minded on issues and that I could bring things to him to say, so a conversation would often go like this on an area that I would talk to him about it. He would ask questions, very good ones. And then at the end of that, he'd say, right, okay, you've convinced me. How do I convince 28 member states? Because it was very different from being the chief scientific advisor for Scotland. Because if I convinced our first minister of something, he, and they were men when I was chief scientific advisor, they could then just go and do something. They could say, it sounds like a great idea. We'll now get the policymakers involved to see what we can do, you know, how we can use this. The structure in the European Union doesn't really allow that to happen, because a large part of what is done by consensus that is reached across the different member states of the European Union. And it's very much more complicated than that. So, there were lots of achievements, I think that I am happy with. But nothing, they were all tended to be smaller things. So there was nothing momentous, you know, like Okay, so one of my proposals, but this didn't go very far, was, you know that the European Parliament meets in Brussels and also Strasbourg. And there was a good philosophical reason for that at the beginning of the European Union. But now when it's mature, there's in my personal view is that if I look at the amount of disruption and money spent on moving the whole Parliament to Strasbourg once a month, for me, for 1 week a month, it's just a dreadful waste of money. And my proposal was that we turn the European Parliament and Strasbourg into Europe's powerhouse technology university institute and so on, you know, a global center for lots of different areas of science, because we had the buildings, we had the money, because if you weren't moving people to Strasbourg every month, then you've got running costs. So to a simple scientist like me, I thought that was a brilliant opportunity which would serve Europe well. The politicians did not agree. So,
well, let's leave the European Union or the structure of the European Union for a second, and let's dive deeper into a topic that seems to be closer to your heart, the genetically modified organisms. And there has really a lot been going on in this area. Did you follow the recent developments?
Well, are you talking about gene editing and yes, I mean, it's very interesting to me, but I've thought about this a lot because I think the main, if there was any controversy around my role at the European Commission, I think a lot of organizations, NGOs, Greenpeace and others attacked me for, and what they said is promoting GMOs. And I never did promote GMOs. All I said was the technology is safe. You know, and if you are thinking about using the technology to, let's say, modify plants to make them disease resistant or drought resistant or whatever, I know that the technology is safe. But on the other hand, if you ask European citizens, I don't know what it would be now, but I think generally most European citizens are not particularly in favor of the technology, particularly for plant breeding. Whereas if I compare traditional methods of plant breeding, they're completely imprecise. We've no idea what we're doing. We don't know if we're going to make the resultant crop species from traditional methods more allergenic to people, or if we introduce another vulnerability in the crop, we'll find it out eventually by growing the plant and so on. It's not regulated. Whereas GM technology is regulated, which I think should give us comfort. But here's the thing. I don't think chief scientific advisors should be involved in recommending or not genetically modified organisms, because all of the arguments that I used to hear from green priests and others, they were all about emotion and they were about big business. They were about industrial agriculture. They weren't really about safety. And I think to their discredit, they often used the accusation of lack of safety in order to make people worried, because it's a very simple message. I mean, if you said to me, here's something, I don't think it's safe to eat, do you want to eat it? I'd say, no, I don't, you know, I'll eat something else, thank you, I don't want to. So it's a very understandable message for the public. And I think time will probably tell that we have done the public a great disservice by not being more open and honest about the technology and what it can offer, so that they can choose or not the technology, but being in full possession of the facts so that they can make a choice. Because I'm thinking particularly of climate change. We need climate smart agriculture. We need to stop using agrochemicals, which are very intensive in terms of fossil fuel usage to produce them. We need to think about, particularly in areas of the globe which will suffer very badly from drought, we need to think about how they can be sustainable in terms of food production with drought-free crops. And traditional plant breeding is unlikely in the timescales that we require solutions to be able to provide solutions. So there you are. It used to be all anyone wanted to talk to me about or accuse me of or whatever. And it's only thinking back that I should have said that I can't talk to you about this because you're talking about something emotional and my emotions are no more valid or not than your emotions, but I can only give you the facts, you know. So there we are.
And it seems like the opinion really has changed on that topic, because only recently the European Commission approved the genome editing tools, and also the European Parliament just recently on the 24th of January approved the genome editing tools. When I did my research, I discovered a paper that said that while in 2010, 60% of the European citizens were uneasy to eat GMO foods, but now it's less than 30%. So the opinion, the opinion has changed. The peak was in 2010. And this is 2 years after you started as chief scientific advisor. So, and since then, the opinion really has changed. So I would like to ask you if you know how you did that, or as you were at the forefront, seems like you had an impact there.
Well, Bernd, you've made my day, but I'll be very honest, I'd like to take some credit for that, but I don't really think, I can't put my finger on something and say, here's the evidence that I changed people's minds, but it was talked about a lot. And I can remember actually some meetings which I would describe as almost heartbreaking, where I had politicians from different African countries come and meet me in Brussels to say, why is it that the European people and your European Parliament will not agree to GM? Because if we could grow GM crops in our country, and thinking of Kenya, if we can grow GM crops there, our problem is that if we have surplus, we can't export. And that some organizations are saying, if Kenya grows GM, don't buy Kenyan flowers, which are exported and so on, because they'll be tainted in some way. Is the anti-GM lobby probably did not always behave as well as they could have done. And I'm being gentle in what I say. I think some things they should look back and be a bit ashamed about. But I just think that, do you remember I said earlier that if you tell people things often enough, they eventually might believe you? And every single learned scientific body across the globe who has done a study into the safety of GM technology has concluded that it is safe. And we are very happy to use GM technology when it comes to producing pharmaceuticals and drugs, which are transfused or injected or ingested into our bodies. So we know the technology is safe. But we did not like, and I understand this, how the technology was used by some big multinational companies as a way of catching people into buying their seeds and their chemicals. But all I would say now is that I think the biggest and most exciting possibility for us with GM and agriculture is to think of having GM organic crops. So using the GM in order that we might not use agrochemicals. And I think that that would make a significant contribution to looking at some of the impacts that humans have on our planet, which result in climate change, because that's the biggest threat that we have, I'm afraid. And you will all experience this. I may not. I don't know, is that the advantage of being older or not?
I mean, but, there are also advances in the research of aging.
Marta, yes, you're telling me. Well, if you need me as a subject, I'm happy to offer you my telomeres.
I'll keep you in mind then. But so you actually just mentioned that, of course, one of the most pressing issues that we have right now is climate change. And personally, we think that there is a common consensus that people are alarmed. We made laws and agreements regarding climate change, but it still seems like no government actually want to make the action. So do you think here we scientists actually failed in our communication in not telling people how urgent it is, or it's just that the listeners on the other side are not ready to take this message in?
No. Scientists haven't had a failure in communication, quite the opposite. You know, they've taken rather a complicated subject with different approaches, direct measurements, modeling, historical data, meteorological data over decades. You know, all of this has been put together in a digestible way for both the public and for politicians. It's a failure of leadership that our politicians are constantly lobbied by powerful influences. This is in every country. And they will be from business and vested interests who, you know, maybe if I owned an oil company, I might be lobbying to keep using the oil. You know, it's just human beings are fragile and weak. And sometimes we don't do the best thing unless we are inspired by leadership. And I think what we do not have is we don't have political leadership. And the only thing that I could say, if I can hijack this podcast, is that I really, really hope and encourage younger people to constantly talk about this and to call out politicians and our political leaders when they do not address our future, because they're mostly older and, you know, they've had the joys of industrial development and, you know, all the pleasures of life, and they do not care. They are not caring about the next generation or the generation after that, and it's a shocking thing. I mean, it's the only thing generally in my life that I am pessimistic about, because I'm an optimist. I always think something good will happen or it's not as bad as it sounds. But with climate change, I have no confidence that the human race will be able to address the issue in a timely fashion. And just simple things. We all talk about immigration all the time. And if I lived in Bangladesh and practically, you know, of, I don't know, it's 180 or 190 million population, small country, most of it is flooded a lot of the time. And if the sea level rises just by a few centimeters, then life for them will not be tenable. So they will move. I would move if I was living somewhere where I was being flooded all the time and I couldn't grow crops and I couldn't work and so on, I would move. And a lot of Bangladeshi people have relatives in the UK, historical links between the countries, and they want to come here. And the people in the UK are saying, we don't want you to come here. You know, we're full up, you know, whatever the arguments are. How will we manage that? Because we will have global migration, people who have to move because they can't stay where they are. Because of climate change, life will not be sustainable, and it will lead to wars and famine and horrors. And now is when we need the leadership, but our politicians do nothing. So in any elections in any of your countries, I would write to, you know, whoever is listening, write to people wishing to be elected and say, you'll only get my support if you spell out how you will lead on the climate change issue. And, you know, that's constantly what we need, is to keep it at the front of people's minds, because in a way, nothing much else matters. Although if you did want me to move to a more optimistic thing, if you're a microbiologist, climate change isn't really a problem for the microbes, that is. So my great love of microbes, when our planet is devoid of human life, there'll still be plant life, there'll be microbial life, and maybe something else will evolve, you know, who knows? It's just that there won't be any humans on the planet. And maybe that doesn't matter. I don't know. Bearing in mind, as I was just reading again today, that I don't know, there's about 10 times more microbial cells in my body than there are human cells. So I'm more than half microbe anyway. So that's always a comforting thought.
We actually discussed what you also mentioned, the problem with leadership, that actually there is some sophisticated, some strong leadership required, but now very often what's happening, what we see is rise of populism. Yeah, people search for simple answers. We have scientific advisors to the government, but still the public opinion very often is against this.
Yeah, so one thing, this isn't an answer, but one thing that I would like to see in our democracies is that when our political leaders come up with policies, they should have to clearly state what evidence they're following in implementing those policies. So they should have to say what the scientific evidence is and how certain it is, because there's always controversy around our scientific knowledge and so on. They should have to say if they're also including economic evidence or philosophical evidence or societal evidence. Again, all of those are very important, because I can think, we probably don't have time, but I can think of very good examples where the scientific evidence would tell you to do one thing, but we don't do it as a society, we do something else. And it's because we're human, you know, and that's not a bad thing. And I would support that. But I think that we should oblige somehow our politicians to let us know how much weight they're giving to each of those, so the public can see. You know, it should be a routine thing. You should be able to look at and see what information they are using and how that information has been verified. Because you're right, with the huge rise of populism and also social media, and it's becoming even more complicated with artificial intelligence, so that, you know, somebody could do this exact same podcast with all our faces, but change what we say by saying, you know, you should never trust us, you know, we are because we're scientists or whatever. You know, you can be so easily manipulated, and people just look at something. And as I said to you before, if you tell people things, they tend to believe them. So if you look, there is a pan-European exercise done every year called, it's done by a company called Ipsos Mori, and it's a kind of polling organization. And it's a thing called the Veracity Index. So who do you trust and who don't you trust? I recommend that you look at it for your particular country. And, you know, it's always really interesting, because scientists are right up at the top. They're not at the top. I think it's nurses or doctors who are at the top, and other professions, teachers are well thought of. But 80 to 85% scientists and engineers are trusted. 50% of the population trusts what their neighbors say or their friends say. So with necessarily, they might not have any expertise, but you trust them. Right at the bottom are journalists and politicians. So we elect these people to represent us, and yet we don't trust them. So we're moving away from scientific advice, but that is very, very challenging for democracies. If we elect people to represent us and we do not trust them, But the positive thing is, if we do trust scientists, then we need to use that trust in us wisely, and we need to put our expertise at the service of the population, our populations, our citizens, our young people, our school children who are having to struggle with all this information, and actually also our journalists and our politicians, our decision-making bodies. We need to, it will be very uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable a lot of the time, but I think we need to do that to try and use that trust that the public inherently has in us for some good purpose.
I'm just thinking about the upcoming elections, actually, for the European Parliament, which will be in June. I know this will not concern you, because unfortunately...
Well, I also have Irish citizenship, so I'm still a member of the European Union.
Okay, great. Okay. But maybe just so, of course, it's hard to base this question, maybe the answer to this question on evidence, but what do you think the future of Europe might look like, especially looking into the next 5 years?
I think this might sound like a very big statement, and it's just my opinion, so it's not necessarily evidence-based, but I think the future of our planet and our world depends on a strong Europe. And I think there are lots of political forces across the world who would like to see the European Union disintegrate and fragment. And that was what was so difficult to accept with Brexit, because, as you will understand, I mean, it's a misery. It's a daily misery here in Britain. We are so much worse off having left the European Union. I don't know how that's reported in the rest of the European Union, but it's so, so much worse. And the very people who were already finding life difficult in Britain, who predominantly voted for it, it's because they've had successive governments in Britain who never did anything for them. And they thought, well, it must be the European Union then, so let's get out of that and then things will get better. And things have just got worse for them. And they were lied to. And I wouldn't normally use that language, but they were lied to by people with vested interests. And if you look at the political spheres all across our world in North America, not always a positive influence. If you look at what's happening in the Middle East, if you look at what's happening perhaps on Europe's borders in Ukraine, all of that is desperately troubling. And I'm not sure we're having honest conversations about any of those issues. And you know, people try to close down discussions about should we be doing this. And, you know, I know you will have seen that. I think yesterday the United States said that they will attack some sites in Iraq. This is a disaster. And yet, again, as citizens, global citizens, we seem powerless to do much about it. So I think that the European Parliament elections and also the presidency of the European Commission, it is vitally important that those people exercise leadership and statesmanship and not just go along with, you know, what the predominant narrative is coming from other parts of the world, whether that be North America. We are distinctive. We're European. We have tremendous culture. We contribute so much globally, both historically, not all of it good, I admit, but we have contributed so much and can contribute so much. And we have such potential power. But also, when I heard yesterday that the European Parliament have decided to reduce the science budget so that we can increase a budget supporting war, it wasn't a happy day for me. So I'm aware that sounds very pessimistic, but, you know, there are good leaders. I just hope that somehow that the public can try and be a bit more discerning, can look past the sound bites, can rely on, you know, we have organizations now in the UK, fact-checking organizations, who will check facts from every political party. I just don't know how many people look at those fact checkers. So, Christophe, I only hope in the European elections that we remind ourselves of the responsibility we as Europeans have to the rest of the world in terms of demonstrating leadership and behaving. I've always thought the European Union could behave in a much longer term timescale than individual governments. It's one of the strengths for me of the European Commission, is that, you know, you're not relying on an electoral cycle. So you do have some vision that you could implement policies that will be longer term, but that we will benefit from, which doesn't happen in member states because you're always thinking about the next election and how you get elected. So you're looking, that is fostering populism. So I don't know. I'm thinking after this, I might have to go and have a very stiff drink, because it's becoming a bit depressing just thinking about it. But still, we have had great leaders, and we could have great leaders. And that's what I'm hoping to see, is in the European Parliament, to see the voice of people who are visionary, who are inspiring, and who understand their obligation to citizens if they are elected, and think less of themselves and more of the job they have to do. There are such people.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your honest answer.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
So I guess we have to wrap up. So thank you, Anne. It was truly amazing to speak to you and to hear about your life work, your research, and, well, we learned many different things, including that politicians are interesting organisms, but the key to communicate with them is knowing who you're talking with, who your audience is. And yeah, let's hope that somehow we will turn into a better future, let's say.
Okay, so thank you, Marta. Thank you, Christophe. And thank you, Bernd. It's been a great conversation. I've enjoyed it very much. Extremely interesting questions. And I've also learnt things as well. So for me, that makes a perfect outcome.
Thank you. Okay. And one last question. So if people want to know more about you, where can they find it? Where can they look you up?
Well, you could start on Wikipedia. I don't know.
As
who
we
does
did
that
too.
Sorry?
Just as we did too.
Yeah, that's right. But and I wish you all the best in your careers as well.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Okay, you're welcome.